This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. You know, you can usually tell by opening weekend how popular a film's going to be. There's a lot of stock placed in those box office numbers, but for cult films, that is not the case. Now, these are films that typically don't do well at first, but years later, they gain a following and take on a life of their own. I mean, you take The Room, for example. There's a film that opened in 2003 in a couple of theaters in Los Angeles and did not do well. Bad reviews, bad audiences. Some publications called it the worst movie ever made, but that's because they didn't see Plan 9 from Outer Space. Today, there are midnight screenings all over the world. And in 2017, of course, James Franco makes his mainstream movie about The Room, which is called The Disaster Artist. So in this edition of Movies on the Radio, we're talking about your favorite cult films. Marsha Gordon and Laura Boys with me. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thanks so much.
Your cult favorite of ours. And Marsha Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Hi, Marsha.
Hello, Frank.
What is a cult film? What do we mean? What are we saying?
That's a great question. And, you know, in some ways, it's a harder category to define than most because, as you said, most often they are not successes at the box office, but sometimes they are. But I think the best way to maybe think about them is that they have this really, really devoted, enthusiastic fan base. And this is a category that's really about audience and the way people see the film more than anything else. And so you have to have kind of the ability to repeatedly view a cult film. So that relies on kind of theaters showing it often over a long period of time. So I think we have to thank drive-in movie theaters, college film societies, the advent of VHS, which allowed people to see films in their own home and to make copies of them and then to share them with other people. So I think that's a big part of this.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, it's interesting to think that one of the original cult films was The Wizard of Oz, because although it was popular when it came out and it was seen by children, it really didn't become hugely popular until it was shown annually on television for the baby boomers, and it became a huge event that everyone looked forward to all year. And then the baby boomers taught it to their children, and now it's really a much bigger phenomenon than it was in its original
release. And that's interesting, because I wouldn't think of The Wizard of Oz as a cult film. I would think of it as a very popular, mainstream, studio, big-money film. I tend to think that cult films are defined partly in opposition to the mainstream, so that they are, eccentric, sometimes grotesque, sometimes deliberately offensive, boundary-pushing, often low budget, campy, not always,
right,
but often.
Well, one of the things that made it a cult film was that gay audiences identified so strongly with it.
That's a great
In fact,
point.
A slang term for someone who is gay used to be a friend of Dorothy. Mm-hmm. And some people even say that the rainbow flag came from the song of Over the Rainbow.
And
so
we're
that,
not in Kansas anymore.
Right.
Becomes
and,
a kind of a catchphrase.
Right.
And, outside.
You know, I'm just a dandelion,
yeah,
that sort of thing. So,
so
that it takes on another meaning
that's
as
a great
well.
Point.
Which speaks to the culture that, right? I mean, that's what we're saying. When we say cult, this is a culture that forms around and sort of outside of the film, the culture that is created because of the film, which can happen regardless of whether it was a success or not, big
right.
budget or not. Is there a life for this film, not just in a lot of people wanting to see it, but in wanting to create lives and personae around the
right.
film?
Right. And does loving a particular film make you special because you love it? And
yeah,
that's a big part of cult as well.
Exactly. And having that community, and whether right. it's sharing the VHS tape or going to the midnight screening together and participating in it, that's absolutely part of the definition.
Here's one of those films that developed its community long after it, or at least shortly after its first screened.
My name is Jackson Cooper. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. My choice for my favorite cult film is Carnival of Souls. Carnival of Souls has gained a huge reputation over the last few decades since it was released. It was very not really seen that much when it first came out because of some distributor problems, so you could only find it in drive-ins and on late-night TV. But over the years, it's influenced many horror films like Insidious, The Sixth Sense, and The Conjuring. While it is low budget and very much a B movie with, you know, sort of some community theater type acting and very low production values, it has a consistent mood and eeriness about it that if you watch it with all the lights out, it's really, truly horrifying.
This used to be quite a place. It's been deserted for a long time now.
Will you take me in?
My goodness, no. It isn't safe out there anymore. That's why they put up this barrier.
It'd be very easy to step around it.
What attraction could there be for you out there?
I'm not sure. I'm a reasonable person, I don't know. Maybe I want to satisfy myself that the place is nothing more than it appears to be. Would you take me out there?
No. The law has placed it off limits. Wouldn't be very seemly for a minister to break the law, would it?
No. Maybe I can come back some other time.
Shall we go along now?
Carnival of Souls, 1962. Cult film?
Well, I love this film. This was made by a man named Herc Harvey, who was an industrial filmmaker for Centron Corporation out of Kansas. And this is the one and only feature film that he made. He also plays the ghoul in the film. I don't find this a schlocky B film at all. I actually think it's incredibly artful. I love the way that it looks. But it circulated as a bootleg until 1990. Finally, somebody gave it a limited theatrical and a legitimate VHS release, and that just kind of exploded. Yeah. I remember seeing it, I don't know, in grad school or college or something, and I don't remember if it was VHS or DVD, but it's a film that is much beloved and I think is on the more artful side of the spectrum that we'll talk about today.
Well, it's visually so incredibly striking, but right at the outset here, you have to kind of get over some of the stiff acting that is actually a feature of so many of these movies. The star persona is not really a big part of cult filmmaking.
Stiff acting and thin storyline, too. but right, it's beautiful and eerie all the way through. Both the soundscape and the cinematography make it absolutely gorgeous. And so beef it up a little bit. We could talk about that for every one of these films, including The Vanishing Point.
Hi, I'm Marianne Wasson in Raleigh, and I was driving when I heard that your next theme was cult classics, and Vanishing Point just popped in my head, you know, like, you have to nominate me. My husband and I saw it soon after it was released, and we found it better than Easy Rider and very compelling, very good movie making. And I think it survives long after Easy Rider, especially because of the Black Blinds radio DJ who cheers on Kowalski and gives him guidance.
The police numbers are getting closer, closer, closer to our sole hero in his sole mobile. They're gonna get him, smash him, rip the last American hero.
That made it more like a Greek odyssey, not just a counterculture film. Because Kowalski, the protagonist, is not counterculture himself. And you know in the movie that it's not like it's a suicide drive, but it is a drive to just put some finish to what's been going on in his life, so that at the very end of the movie, you actually know what's coming.
Spoiler alert. Vanishing Point, 1971, starring Barry Newman as Kowalski.
Well, in the 1970s, there were a number of kind of road to nowhere kind of movies, like Two-Lane Blacktop, where, you know, the destination is the journey kind of thing.
Monty Hellman.
Yeah, exactly. And this one, it has fantastic driving, great action sequences, and that sort of ambiguous ending that the 70s was so fond of.
And a 1970 Dodge Challenger to
boot. It was Cleavon Little, by the way, a superstar DJ. Yeah.
So I was poking around a little bit about this film in a newspaper archive database, and so this comes out in 1971, right? So I find this Louisville, Kentucky movie theater advertisement from 1976, so 5 years after the film is released, and it's playing in three drive-ins and three movie theaters in Louisville, Kentucky in 1976, and it's playing alongside films like Rocky Horror Picture Show, Manson, Taxi Driver, Tommy. This is an example of how there has to be this kind of arc over time of these films where people want to come back and see them again and again. Word of mouth spreads. There's a kind of patience to the development of the cult film, and this is a perfect example.
You want to watch a movie about a car in a car.
Yes.
Maybe that's it.
Good point.
But how about staying power? Is it a movie for the 70s and could be a cult film in the 70s, but loses some of that appeal maybe in the 90s and then the 2000s?
Is there a
fair comparison? Also, what about the Easy Rider comparison? Was that a comparison being made at the time?
I find Easy Rider to be pretty much unwatchable now.
Yeah.
Well, I think in some ways, you know, so many films that are trying to be of their moment, we look at them and they still seem very much of their moment. And so they age in that way. And I think it's a fair enough kind of tastemaker thing to say that this is a kind of more interesting version of kind of 70s.
Well, it's interesting. The more well-made films are the ones that are less likely to endure as cult films because they have the less wackiness to kind of play with, right?
Right. And I was watching a lot of car movies when there was a car show at the museum.
Because you were in the drive-ins for so many.
And this was one of the better ones. But because I felt there was only one slot for the existential 70s car movie, we showed Two-Lane Blacktop instead. But, I mean, this is also a really strongly flavored film.
And I think part of also this story of the cult film is people feel like they have discovered something that's interesting that critics don't necessarily tell them is interesting, right? So we like to find our own stuff.
Because there are no real stars in this movie either.
No, so many of these films that we're going to talk about today are not, they're not star-rich, big-budget films.
The stars of our show, Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon, Movies on the Radio, cult classics. There's plenty more ahead, including Pink Flamingos. And much, much more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio today, talking about your favorite cult movies. I'm joined by Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura, the film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University. And you called in with your favorite cult classics.
Hi, my name is Bill Nichols, and my cult classic is The Ruling Class, which was released in 1972. It is a British black comedy starring Peter O'Toole as the Earl of Gurney. O'Toole is his usual flamboyant self. In this role, he plays, or at least as Earl, he plays himself as Jesus Christ.
First, I shall command the Pope to consecrate a plane load of contraceptives for the priest-ridden Irish. Pax et benedictus and uctorius nostrum in dominus verbiscum. Arise, shine, for my light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee.
Here is the brag, see how it goes. Down on your heels, up on your toes. That's the way to do the varsity drag.
He's healed at the end of the movie and becomes Jack the Ripper. What makes it a black comedy is it's a commentary on the English aristocratic class and how absurd and bizarre it can be.
Everybody down on the heels, up on the toes, stay after school, learn how it goes. Everybody do the varsity, everybody do the varsity, everybody do the varsity drag.
Ruling Class, 1972.
I loved this movie when I was in college, partly because it was Peter O'Toole at his dreamiest. I love that 1920s music, but it was about how rich people can basically get away with anything. Something that would a poor person would get thrown in jail, a rich person gets a pass on it. And the irreligious nature of it, too. They ask Peter O'Toole, how does he know he's God? And he says, when I pray to him, I find I'm talking to myself.
The very definition of narcissism. How you can find yourself in a leadership position with an attitude like that is beyond me.
Unbelievable.
1972. Well, let's talk about, you talked about this being a film that you saw in college. This one, if I was a caller and had to call in, I would have joined John Morrison on this one.
My name's John Morrison, and I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And the movie I chose was Pink Flamingos. The way I found out about it was back at Indiana University when I was an undergraduate. It was a particularly cold winter day, and I decided it'd be wise to take the bus. While I was on the bus, I saw an ad for the movie, and you could see this picture of Divine. It's a classic pose of Divine, holding a gun, wearing a red fishtail dress, and it said, Pink Flamingos. an exercise in bad taste.
Gentlemen of the press, get ready, because you are about to witness the biggest news event of the year. Live homicide. Connie and Raymond Marble, you have breathed your last breath. You have sighed your last sigh. You are no longer alive. Connie Marble, you stand convicted of assholism. The proper punishment will now take place. Look pretty for the picture, Connie. No further questions, no further pictures. I have spoken.
Thanks for the scoop, Divine. Next month's sales should be booming.
Thank you for coming.
And it's kind of interesting how it was inspired. There's a book by John Waters called Shock Value. And in this autobiography, he tells how the movie's made. And he also tells what inspired it. He hitchhiked across the United States and stayed in a lot of cheap trailer parks and saw the seedier side of American life. And this movie was a great satire of that.
There we go, the 1972 film Pink Flamingos.
I think Mike Pence was at that screening as well.
He was the chicken. Very few people know that. It was great costume design.
So I was president of my college film society when this movie came out.
Awesome.
And I went to a convention, like a Booker's convention, and I talked to the people at New Line Cinema, and who distributed the film, and they were like, "Oh my God, we can't watch this movie. It's so horrible." It's like, "You're on."
So you booked it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that was it. It was booked in my college, too. And I saw this thing, and it was 1972. This was the decade, just past the decade of transgression. But that was the thing about the film. It was really so far off the pale,
right.
So far beyond the pale. I thought, well, if you can make a movie like this, there's hope for all of us.
And the fact that John Waters has become mainstream must amuse him no end.
I am sure. But yeah, the idea of like trash cinema, deliberately offensive, something that's so over the top. I mean, and people enjoy having those kind of boundaries pushed on the big screen and having a good time watching it.
Toppled, I'd say. Monty Python and the Holy Grail was your choice, Laura. Now, this, some would argue, not a cult film.
Yes, not a cult film because... So Monty Python was on PBS. The the Flying Circus was on PBS.
Yes.
You might argue that people who watch PBS are also a cult, but that's probably a different show. But
the cult of the hypernormal.
So this film was made while they were still making the TV series for a very small amount of money, about $400,000, and it grossed about $5 million globally, which is not a huge amount. And of course, it spawned Spamalot, which is a huge Broadway hit. But to me, the thing that makes it a cult movie is that it has such a long life on home video formats that every middle school student memorizes all the routines and bores everyone incessantly with their...
Only a flesh wound.
I'm the knight who says knee.
Yeah, well, let's hear how they did it.
Who are you?
We are the knights who say knee.
No, not knee. The knights who say knee.
The same.
Who are they?
We are the keepers of the sacred words. Knee, peng, and knee-wum.
Those who hear them seldom live to tell the tale.
The knights who say ni demand a sacrifice.
Knights of ni, we are but simple travelers who seek the enchanter who lives beyond these woods.
Ni! Ni!
Ow!
Ni!
No!
No! Ni! 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 We shall say ni again to you if you do not appease us.
Well, what is it you want?
We want a shrubbery!
A what?
Knee!
No. Please, please, no more. We will find you a shrubbery.
You must return here with a shrubbery, or else you will never pass through this wood alive.
There's a lot of people laughing on Interstate 40.
That's great stuff.
So when this film came out, Kevin Thomas in the LA Times did a one-paragraph review of it, in which he deemed it disappointing. And he said, "A King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table travesty, best left to those who find frequent and graphic decapitation and dismemberment a laugh riot. So that turns out to be, you know, half of the free world, basically. So
rated PG, I'll have you know.
Right. Well, because it was only a flesh wound.
Only a flesh wound, exactly. Yeah.
This is about taste.
Yes.
It's about taste.
Flatulence in your general direction. it's a fine film. And, you know, and that's the, by the way, $400,000. John Cleese says the fact, you know, they had the coconut shells for horses because they didn't have money for horses. And Michael Palin says, why don't we use coconut shells? And they put it in the movie.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
That's right. Story.
Well, this one you knew was going to come up sooner or later. We thought we saved it for the middle of the show.
My name is Kate Lee, and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. My Rocky Horror experience began sometime in the early 80s. The Coconut Grove Cinema showed it every Friday and Saturday night for many years.
Brad, please, let's get out of here.
For God's sake, keep a grip on yourself, Janet.
But it seems unhealthy here.
It's just a party, Janet.
Well, I want to go.
Well, we can't go anywhere till I get to a phone.
Well, then ask the butler or someone.
Just a moment, Janet. We don't want to interfere with their celebrations.
This isn't the Junior Chamber of Commerce, Brad.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own. They may do some more folk dancing.
Look, I'm cold, I'm wet, and I'm just plain scared.
I'm here. There's nothing to worry about.
How'd you do, I?
Turned out there were a whole group of us that came over from the western suburbs that all attended the same high school. And one of the friends I connected with there at some point in the future became my daughter's father. Many years later, when my daughter was 18, she was living in New York and working in a retail establishment. And Susan Sarandon came in, actually. And my daughter went up to her and was like, oh my gosh, my parents met. And Susan Sarandon responded, at Rocky Horror. And they were both sharing a very good laugh over that.
By the light of the night, it'll all seem all right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great story. Rocky Horror Picture Show, of course, 1975, and yet it endures.
Because it's actually good. The performances yeah. are good. It's campy in a very right. knowing way. Right. It's supposed to be ridiculous. It's got fantastic music. It's got Meatloaf. It's got Tim Curry. It's got whatever you need.
Well, and this participatory screening experience, right? That makes, I mean, that started in New York City. And now, by the way, in Raleigh, North Carolina, you can go to the Rialto a few Fridays a month and have the same experience. They're still doing midnight Rocky Horror Picture screenings. And this is happening all over the country. So this is something that has endured the test of time.
Generation after generation.
Yeah. Was there any precedent for that? Or was that the first time?
I don't think there was.
I think that was it. I think this was the breakthrough.
It's amazing that a language and a vernacular and a sort of choreography, I mean, it all grows up around this utterly spontaneously in some ways. And that the movie houses figured it out. I mean, everybody sort of lined up around this.
But
thing.
It also, it taps into that musical aspect, right? And musicals, obviously, it's like, it fits in the genre history, but it's so playful and it allows people to kind of sing and align themselves with it in a different way, I think, in part because the music and a lot of the films we're talking about today have an important musical aspect if they are not musicals already.
The Forbidden Zone would be a pretty good example, and that's your pick, Marcia.
So when I was thinking about my pick for this show, for a while I was like, oh, I don't know, maybe, and I was like, oh my gosh, I have an actual cult film experience that I had totally forgotten about, when I was an undergraduate in California, I had a friend who had this VHS tape that he had bought for 99 cents at a 7-Eleven someplace near Las Vegas and had, you know, come home and watched it and was like, shared it with everyone, made copies. And it was this film called The Forbidden Zone from 1980, directed and produced by Richard Elfman, who is the brother of Danny Elfman, who is now a composer of every single movie and television show that you see. But at the time, they were in a band called the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo.
What are you ever talking about?
Squeezing Henderson's got a brother that dresses like a broad.
And he took us down into the basement. He showed us those funny games, you know, like the adults play. Yeah. And he went through a door, and he never came out.
A door leading to the sixth dimension? How strange, yet intriguing. Just imagine the adventurous world beyond that door.
You don't ever.
That's a clip from the 1980s. So tell us more. If we didn't have, say, the 99 cents for this film, what should we know about
it? So it's absurd, grotesque, crass, bawdy, arty, and it's a series of these amazing kind of cabaret musical numbers that are strung together by this preposterous story about the sixth dimension. Hervé Villechaize, who was tattooed on Fantasy Island, is in the film. It is, it's insane, and there's no other way. And I remember just, I loved that I had access to this super edgy, weird thing, and I hadn't seen it in 20 plus years, and went down to the Video Vortex store at Alamo Drafthouse, and lo and behold, there was a copy of The Forbidden Sin, so I got to rewatch it, and it's as insane as it was when I first saw it.
It's interesting that the song you played is the Oingo Boingo version of a song I first heard in a Three Stooges comedy.
Yeah, well, they recycled a lot of Cab Calloway, like 20s, 30s stuff in this film.
That's
as well.
Really, I mean, it's a bit of sampling, you know, kind of an early example of that, and for that reason, it is actually captivating. You sort of can't take your eyes and ears off of it.
Even
no
if you want to.
How much you want to.
No, people are saying, has he been drinking? Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Dan Tullidge. I'm calling from Hillsborough, North Carolina. And I'd like to share that my favorite cult film is Blade Runner. And it's the original Blade Runner, actually. It's set in dystopian Los Angeles. If you hadn't seen it, you got to see it. It has almost zero, I think it has zero CGI in it, which is fantastic. But there's been many, many versions of it done. And I have a collection of all the versions, but I still like the original version, which is a film noir version where Harrison Ford is doing a voiceover. He plays the part of Deckard, who is the Blade Runner, the guy who catches the androids.
You're reading a magazine. You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl.
Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?
Just answer the questions, please.
Would you step out for a few moments, Rachel? Thank you.
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
1982, Blade Runner. The original.
So this was a box office failure. But what's interesting is I think you can trace the history of cult films and think about the history of distribution, because this is a film that got kind of caught up in bidding wars for pay television, actually. So if you remember the birth of HBO and pay-per-view and things like that. So it kind of came out at a moment where there was this secondary life that was being built into the distribution system. And that's how a lot of people saw this film over and over again.
Although I saw it out of focus at the old Cameron Village Theaters many, many years ago.
Part of its charm.
Part of its charm, yes.
Hi, this is Charles Humble from Chapel Hill. I was living in New Mexico in 1984 when this movie Repo Man came out. It is set in a world, it actually starts in New Mexico, and it involves a wacky scientist who has stolen some powerful meteor or something, and has it in the back of a car, and he's driving down the road in New Mexico, and he's pulled over by a cop and who sees that the trunk is smoking, and the cop says,
"What you got in the trunk?"
"You don't want to look in there."
The very next scene you see is a bunch of government agents checking out the site, and all that's left of the trooper is a pair of boots and a puddle on the road. And from there, much craziness ensues. The car makes it to L.A. And there we meet Emilio Estevez. All that Estevez says for the first half of the movie is lines that I just can't quote here, because they are just dirty, dirty, dirty. He's an angry young man. But somehow he meets the repo man. And he gets into the repo business, and it is one weird world.
1984, Repo Man.
Well, this is, I love Repo Man. It's a punk rock science fiction.
With great LA bands, too.
Yeah, yeah. And a car trunk out of Kiss Me Deadly, I would say.
Yep. Absolutely. And yet, it's interesting because, like, Roger Ebert, for example, really liked this film. So this was not a film that was just critically panned, but he said, you know, there's no stars, it has low budget, and yet it's really fun and interesting and it's worth seeing. So
it's one of those films where really the plot is everything and they just get to it. I mean, there's not a lot of sort of messing around and lots of exposition for getting you there. It's like you want something in your trunk and blow up the cop. Okay, we get it now. And so on we go. And another thread, the whole other thread of this sort of repo universe that's part of it. So that's the kind of storytelling that can take a film that's got some problems and at least hold it up a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
Does this film have, so how is this doing these days? Is it sort of still have cult status?
I mean, I watched it a bunch of times in college and grad school. I don't know if young people are still watching and discovering this film.
I heard that it was
kids
a
today.
Funny movie when my parents came to visit and I went and rented it and said, oh, yeah, dirty, dirty, dirty. It was kind of a rough
Did
90
you spend
minutes.
The whole time bleeping?
It was, well... I was a manual bleep.
Yes.
I was just today, Movies on the Radio, talking about your favorite cult films with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys, and we will have more just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio, your favorite cult films with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State University. Laura, the film curator at North Carolina's Museum of Art. And of course, we had callers. Tell us what their favorite cult film was.
Hi, my name is Phil Napoli. I'm from Durham, and my cult movie selection is The Hidden. I picked it because it reminds me of my youth, the glory days of the 80s, when you could discover all sorts of weird stuff at the video store, and the clerks would let you rent whatever you wanted, and no one seemed to care what you brought home. So The Hidden is an action movie featuring a alien body-hopping criminal that just has come to Earth and is moving from body to body with no other purpose but to commit crime.
Why three law-abiding citizens all of a sudden go crazy and start killing people?
We're talking spacemen here.
Finds a body, gets inside, uses it to move around.
I want this car.
Jonathan Miller would never do anything to break the law.
I need the keys. Thank you. Bye.
Something strange is happening.
It's weird. It's a classic piece of 80s action and, you know, the kind of thing you only discovered at the video store on a Friday night when everything else was rented.
There we go. The Hidden.
Yeah, and that's right, because a lot of films have very brief releases if they're not bringing in money. So it didn't have time to build an audience, and then it comes out on VHS, and it's got, you know, as long as it needs.
Or it can go straight to video.
That's right.
Yeah, that's it. Well, direct to video. And I think at that point, producers and directors may have been thinking about these niche audiences. How do I may not need a blockbuster and get everybody in. I can find my niche and do that film. Let's go to another one right now.
This is Lucas Hildebrand calling from Los Angeles, California, talking about Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story by Todd Haynes. This is a film that has achieved cult status largely because of its illicit circulation. So it's a film that was removed from distribution early on in its life because of music rights from the Carpenter's music. And so it's circulated primarily by people sharing videotapes originally, and now it circulates online, but it's basically become a cult film largely because of the ways in which it circulates from person to person outside of official distribution networks. But it's also a film that I think generates a great deal of love and cult following just because of the novelty of a film featuring dolls to the sounds of the Carpenters, but one that still has a great deal of humanity and generates a lot of emotional response.
Now, Richard, I'm not trying to criticize. You know we love your music. All I'm saying is that it needs more
punch.
Exactly, to break in. What you need is a singer.
Mother, I can't sing and play keys and lead a band all at the same
time. What is that? Is that Karen? It is Karen. Richard, I think we just found you your singer.
And lost me my drum.
Yeah. Was that you just now singing?
Sorry, too loud?
No.
Mom thinks that you should sing lead.
What? No way.
Never fall in love again. Oh, I'll never fall in love again.
Superstar from, when was that, 1988?
Yeah, so I saw this film on a VHS dub in college for the first time, and I just very recently got to see a private screening of a restoration of the film. It still can't show publicly because of the rights issues. And I have to say, I think it is a brilliant, brilliant film. It's kind of like an experimental documentary biopic, and I think it's very moving. And I really hope that that one day more people can get the chance to see it.
I actually saw it in a super secret midnight screening at a film festival.
Awesome.
Everyone whispered, mm-hmm. "We're showing this movie."
And it really is doll animation.
It's Barbies.
It's Barbies.
You can't believe that you're watching a movie about Barbies that is making you cry.
Yeah.
But it totally does. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. Let's move on now to another film, Empire Records.
My name is Amanda Allen, and I'm calling from Silva, North Carolina. My favorite cult movie is Empire Records. I started watching it when I was in high school, probably about 10 years after it came out. And it really resonated with me as a high school student, as a teenager, because it's got all of these young people who are dealing with these really complicated problems, but it only covers a day in their life. And they have all of this stuff going on. And they have this great manager at the store who really cares about them. And that really spoke to me as a teenager.
I'm the idiot, you're the screw up, and we are all losers.
Now, five friends have one day to decide what to do with the rest of their lives.
I will offer myself to Rex Manning.
I wish I could be brave.
You are brave.
I have to bring Rex his lunch.
I'm bringing Rex his lunch!
Mark's raging mad. Best day he's had.
Help me.
If I was in a band, they would not be doing this to me.
What is wrong with you people?
Rock and roll.
I've watched it over and over as an adult, and while I don't feel stuck in those teenage problems, I still see those as big issues and like the way that they come together as a family of employees. And it makes me really nostalgic for those record stores that we used to have. Another part of it that makes it such a cult classic for me is that it's really driven by the music. The soundtrack to this movie is spectacular, and I've listened to it over and over and over through the years.
Well, you can't sleep in my bed no more. You can't ride in my car.
Empire Records from 1995.
Well, this is a very big millennial touchstone. My daughter, you know, it's like you have to watch this movie because everybody that I know is really important to us.
When it came out, I read a pan review of it that said it was a soundtrack album in search mm-hmm. of a movie.
but isn't that what soundtrack albums
but it's,
are?
It's kind of like a millennial version of The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Big chill, that kind of thing. Well, let's listen to another one that is not that.
Hi, this is Keith Ward. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And this is my take on Night on Earth. There are no lessons or epiphanies. It's just what's experienced and the impact, however subtle it may have on just the meeting of strangers in our lives. And the cool thing about it is it's, you know, set in five major cities and the stories are happening simultaneously. I picked the New York story as one of my favorite ones just because the connection between the driver and Giancarlo Esposito's character and Rosie Perez just creates a really comical, however, at the same time, there's a sense of family that Giancarlo is trying to express to Rosie Perez, and she's just not having it, and the cab driver himself is kind of in this English as a second language position.
Look, Angela, just calm down!
Don't tell me to calm down!
She's really beautiful. She's beautiful. Yeah, you think so, huh?
Yes. Thanks.
You're welcome.
What's your name?
Helmut. His name is Helmut Lampshade.
No, my name is Helmut Krokenberger. Yeah, you can read it. Helmut Krokenberger.
Wait. I'm driving with a fucking idiot and some clown.
Oh, yes, I'm a clown. Yeah, Angela, it's true.
Shut up!
No, it's true. Check it out.
Shut up.
Hey, come on, Helmut. Show her. Do that horn thing you did, man.
Yes.
Yes.
See, what I tell you, Angela?
Night on Earth from 1991.
Well, this dates from the days when a cab would not take you to Brooklyn. I don't believe that's true anymore. Mm-hmm. Jim Jarmusch, in a way, is kind of a cult director. He's continued making movies that I love that I'm not sure that many people see. His most recent movie was Patterson with Adam Driver, where he plays a poetry writing bus driver. It was fantastic. I tell everybody they have to see Patterson.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten a lot of takers yet.
This is the only movie of all the movies that we were talking about today that I actually saw in a movie theater, which I think is amazing.
Oh,
and I just think it's the only one that I saw for the first time, I should say, in a movie theater, that was my first encounter with it.
Wow.
Yeah,
and that was the English version, but then in the other locales, they're all done in that
language, and they're subtitled.
And subtitled, which makes it a kind of an interesting film.
Yes,
in other words, everybody's
And actually, there's the Italian story is Roberto Benigni, and he tells a story that's so dirty. A priest in the back seat has a heart attack and dies, and then he has to figure out how to dispose of the body.
Yeah, tell us the story. You can't do that.
I don't think I can do
in
that.
In Italian.
Give us a clue.
Hi, my name is Matthew Emmett. I'm calling from Onslow County, North Carolina, and I'm here to talk about the movie Clue. I first saw this movie back in the 90s when it was on Comedy Central, and I even watched it for a high school class one time. I've seen it 25 times at least. I have the DVD of it. And the thing that makes this movie cult to me is the unusual characters and the kind of unusual setting. The characters are all complicated and they're all very distinct from each other. They all have a shtick, but they're not overtly heroic. They're not taking up the entire movie. And the interactions between them and the kind of unusual plot is what drives the humor in this movie.
The game's up, Scarlett. There are no more bullets left in that gun.
Oh, come on. You don't think I'm going to fall for that old trick?
It's not a trick. There was one shot at Mr. Body in the study, two for the chandelier, two at the lounge door, and one for the singing telegram.
That's not six.
One plus two plus two plus one.
Uh-uh. There was only one shot that got the chandelier. That's one plus two plus one plus one.
Even if you were right, that would be one plus one plus two plus one, not one plus two plus one plus one.
Okay, fine. One plus two plus one. Shut up! The point is, there's one bullet left in this gun, and guess who's gonna get it? Oh! Ah!
Where's the chief? Ah, Wadsworth. Well done.
I did warn you, my dear.
Wadsworth, don't hate me for trying to shoot you.
Frankly, Scarlett, I didn't give a damn. As I was trying to tell you, there are no bullets left in this gun, you see?
And that's how the movie ends. No, it's not. Clue from
This is a movie based on a board game, my friends. Yeah. I mean, that's a weird concept to start off with. But I'm glad that the caller mentioned Comedy Central, because we haven't talked about Mystery Science Theater and that's playing B movies and kind of creating cult films and laughing at them and making jokes. I mean, that was part of the culture of the 80s and 90s.
And is there the cult of the B movie? I mean, that's a whole other thing. I want to get to one that's a little bit controversial. There are two here that we want to talk about, but let's get to the Fight Club. Let's get to the Fight Club right now.
Hi, I'm James Pita from Knightdale, North Carolina. And I saw Fight Club when I was about 15 and in high school. I became immediately obsessed with it. You know, it's very inventive and transgressive. You know, I took everybody to see it. I took my friends. I took my dad. I even took my mom. You know, it's so wild, really, that you want to talk about it to everyone. But you know, when you talk about it, you're breaking the first two rules of Fight Club.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
And over the years, really, when you watch it again and again, as I have, you start to realize that, you know, it's not all about fun and sticking it to the man or whatever. It's about the dangers of fascism and just the need we all have to be a part of a group.
Man, I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. Damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. The middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war.
Our Great Depression is our lives.
Fight Club, 1999. Is it a cult film? You thought it wasn't? You didn't like
that?
I
don't know. I question that a little bit. I mean, just, you know, David Fincher, Brad Pitt, Edward Norton.
But we said it's life of its own. People have had their own fight clubs as a result.
Maybe. I feel like maybe there was one fight club, because who would do that? But
you don't know because they can't tell you.
That may be true. That may be true. But, you know, it's funny because who am I to say if it's a cult film or not? Because it's really based on how people experience it. And if they feel like they are creating a cult around it, then maybe it is.
Interestingly enough, this one did not come to us by way of listeners, but it is one that is almost on everybody's list, The Room.
I did not hit her. It's not true. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask.
I used to know a girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them found out about it, beat her up so bad she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
What a story, Mark.
Yeah, you can say that again.
Yeah, but please don't. The Room, a really badly produced movie that is now kind of a cult favorite. And here's the thing. It didn't come up in our list. Amanda Magnus, one of our producers here on The State of Things, has a story. And I think the stories about The Room are what make it a cult classic in some ways. Amanda, you saw this film.
So, yes, I did see this. My partner, Nick, insisted that I see it when it came up for a screening at like a local Brew and View thing when I was living in Madison. And I didn't know anything going into it. I just thought this was a normal movie. He didn't really tell me much. And as soon as we got there, there were these little instructions that people were handing out that said, no throwing spoons at the screens. You can't throw spoons at the screens. And I was like, what is this?
And then he's telling you, you've got to see it.
He's like, we have to see this. I can't believe this is going to, they're doing a screening. We have to go.
And you went, and did you?
I did not really like it. Nick loves it. He still quotes it. Oh, hi, Mark. We say that a lot. But yeah, no, it's not one of my favorites.
So I have not I have resisted seeing this film so far. Although I feel like I might have to eventually. But I mean, it strikes me from the outside, having not seen it but read about it, that it has to be a deliberately bad movie. That there's this kind of mythology, and maybe again I could be totally wrong, I haven't seen it yet, but people do have this enthusiasm for seeing something so bad that they have the ability to laugh at it without feeling bad.
Particularly if you're questioning that very thing, it's like professional wrestling. If you're really saying, oh, did they do this on purpose? Then nobody can act that bad. I mean, that I think is what elevates this thing to cult status. We're practically out of time, but go ahead.
It also seems to me that this was like a kind of deliberately cult film, trying to create a cult film and create a Rocky Horror experience.
Because I only saw The Disaster Artist, and I had to wonder, do we really need to spend all this time glorifying a terrible movie?
It won an Oscar. My guest, didn't it? The Disaster
Artist? It won something, because I remember Jen Franco strong-arming Tommy off the stage.
That's Laura Boyd. She's the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon is a film professor at NC State. They are the stars of Movies on the Radio. We're going to do it again next month. Not next month, in 2 months.
Yes.
So we're not going to tell you what we're going to do it about because
it's a secret.
We got plenty of time.
It's a secret.
State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. Al Wodarski is running the board today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.